ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sometimes I like to think of The Mindfield as a show whose time has come, and occasionally it's discussing a topic whose time has come, mostly not, but I think this week we are. Quite a remarkable moment in the history of The Mindfield in some ways. Waleed Ali is my name as we try to negotiate the ethical, moral dilemmas of modern life, and I do so with my co-host, Scott Stevens. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. I feel like we need to timestamp this one.
We might need to because,
Well, you've been busy.
I've been busy. Yes, but in a way, this is a show that is about one of the big political questions that rises, I think, to the level, or maybe sinks to the level, of a tectonic plate in politics and the way we think about politics. It happens to be in a week, and we'd planned this well before, that we have one of our two oil refineries having caught fire in Geelong in Victoria. Significant 10% of the country's fuel supplies, 50% of the state's fuel, state of Victoria's fuel, it supplies. And so it just made this, well, newsy in a way that perhaps we hadn't anticipated. And so we're going to have to get into this conversation knowing that that is the backdrop to this. I guess someone has added a certain urgency to it. Anyway, all of that to come. Scott, we do have some housekeeping to do, I know, which you always enjoy.
Well, I don't necessarily enjoy it, but these two are actually pretty interesting. The first thing to note is we've already had one show that we've recorded in front of a live audience. We did promise that there are going to be more to come. If you happen to be in Sydney on Sunday, the 24th of May, we are, in fact, recording a live episode of The Mindfield at the Sydney Writers' Festival. We're actually going to be discussing a topic that's pretty closely related to the one that we're discussing today, which is whether the resurgence of nationalism is, in fact, threatening democracy and whether that would be such a bad thing if it were. Our guest is going to be Canadian political columnist and commentator David Moskrop. I'll include some details on this week's webpage for this week's episode. But if you're in Sydney, we'd really love to have you there. The other thing is a bit of a forward announcement because we need people to do a bit of homework. We have this year's first Mindfield Not Quite a Book Club episode. And this is a good one. This is a good one. We're doing a genre, an art form we haven't done in this extended series before. We're doing theater. And just when you thought it was going to be something boring like Shakespeare, oh no. Instead, we're looking at one of the early masterpieces of modern theater, something that it was lean, shocking, embracing, conventional, maybe, transgressive, possibly. Anyway, it's incredibly well known. Christopher Marlowe's 1592 play, Dr. Faustus. It's not overly big. We're going to be looking at the A text, which is shorter, runs to about 57 pages.
So there's an A text and a B text.
An A text and a B text.
And the A text is earlier, and that's the one we're using, and it's shorter than the B text.
Yes, it's a foundational story of Western culture. We will include a link where you can read it online. It's not as difficult as you think. It pays off lingering with this particular text. And we'll be bringing you that episode at some stage in the middle of May. We'll give you a more precise date for
it. Probably the most work we've asked you to do for a book club, but it's still not too much.
Jane Austen's Emma was pretty steep.
I suppose that's true, but you could watch the film.
Yeah, true.
But yes, you'd be familiar with Dr. Faustus anyway. If it's not ringing a bell, it is because the Faustian pact, selling your soul to the devil, all that sort of stuff. You're familiar with the themes. So at least you've got a head start in that regard. All right, so that's coming up. All right, Scott, I'm going to frame this around the concept of sovereignty. It's a broad concept. In some ways, it's the central concept to the Westphalian system of states, which is what we have. At least we have the legacy of that. But it arrives as a concept with a new urgency, I think, in political discourse at a time when the convention over the past at least 30 years, and I think you could go back a lot longer, actually, is that prosperity, that human flourishing is actually best served by, to some extent, willingly, I suppose, surrendering our sovereignty to relationships of interdependence. Okay. Think global free trade, think, if not the free and unrestricted movement of people, then certainly a relatively frictionless movement of people, more frictionless than could otherwise be. Borders coming down a little bit, perhaps quite a lot. Economies being built on the understanding that we don't need a kind of nationalism that controls everything. We don't need to create or produce everything that we require in our lives. We can outsource this to other countries. We can build it on a notion of comparative advantage where everyone just makes the thing that they are best placed to make and then buys the stuff they are not best placed to make from other people.
Can I add a footnote there?
You can.
I think one of the really important ideas behind that isn't just kind of neoliberal frictionlessness or the natural flows of global capital. There is actually a moral principle behind the notion of interdependence that you've been describing. And it's not just, comparative advantage, each nation doing what it does best and then reaping the best possible rewards by that thing being bought or those things being bought by nations that are maybe without. There's also the idea, and this is one that goes right back to the likes of Montesquieu in the 17th century, to someone like, Giuseppe Mazzini, who was one of the kind of intellectual figures behind the idea of cross-national, international institutions, the idea of productive globalization. The notion, in other words, that if we trade with one another, we are less likely to want ill for one another. If we trade, it's not just that we gain a certain degree of advantage because they are willing to pay more for our goods. It's also that by becoming interdependent on other nations, it really becomes the political or the geopolitical equivalent of wanting the very best for one's neighbor. And so the idea is that if we open up trade lines, if we enter into covenants or contracts of reciprocal mutual benefit under the guise of interdependence. You need me, I need you. And there is something about that acknowledgement of mutual need whereby we both become more prosperous as the result of it and less likely then to go to war over adjacent territory.
And not necessarily because of some kind of deep-seated love, although possibly that can arise. Mm. But because of mutual interest, that to go to war with you is now to go to war with myself and my own interests.
And the logic of interdependence then really flared up in 1973 during the OPEC oil shock, where those nations that had a kind of proprietary advantage over oil stocks suddenly turned that off to their Western consumers. And it was this idea that significant supplies of energy, of food, of fuel, that these can be used as weapons by means of which we can punish other nations. That's something that then created these thicker networks of interdependence that then run across the world, a kind of mutual agreement that we're not going to do that to one another. And it's that very established, longstanding, 50-year-old now network of interdependence that has become so baked into the way that we do things that it gives rise to the very possibility of the sorts of renewed oil shocks that we saw in 2022 after the invasion of Ukraine and now with the conflict in the Middle East.
And if you want to go deeper on this, and I would only do so briefly because it's not this show, that has really been the basis of American imperial power to the extent that you want to call it imperial. It's not imperial in the classic sense, we understand. But American power has been capable of being projected through the world through networks of interdependence. Think of the reliance people have on American technology, for example. Think of the extent, the genius of American power has been that it has created a system that other nations of the world wanted to buy into. That is, they didn't need to be conquered. They would sign up because they would get these sort of leveraging benefits, if you like, the benefits of the interdependence with the United States at the center of it. One of the incredible phenomena of the Trump presidency has been the determination to undo that. In other words, to collapse back on a far less modern form of power, which is all about force, direct leverage, and so on. That is, and this
the
is
the exact kind of tribute as well, charging tolls for the use
tariffs
of
and that's so right. on. Yeah. So, but this was Mark Carney's point, the Canadian Prime Minister, that now this interdependency has been turned into a weapon. Okay. So there's that. Then there's the war in Iran. All right. What happens in the war in Iran? Well, you don't need me to tell you this story. The Strait of Hormuz closes. Iran, well, they don't close it totally, but they heavily restrict it. They allow some ships to go through, particularly Chinese ones. But what you see is another oil shock, slightly different in nature, but nonetheless, there it is. And then ceasefire, negotiations falling apart, maybe they'll restart, all these sorts of things.
Blockades.
Bottom line is, but yeah, then a blockade. Bottom line is, oh, we're back at fuel crisis. Now, it is in this context, and I should not say it's only in this context. This is a conversation that has been building for a while. Anyone who has been listening to Andrew Hastie, for example, for, well, since last year, at the very least, will know this has been building for a while. The idea that what actually we should be doing as we abandon the liberal order of interdependence and integration, and certainly economic integration, and to some extent cultural integration, which becomes another, well, it was the other thing that happened this week, wasn't it? The coalition announcing it's the first tranche in its new immigration policy. So, all right, all these things become connected. And sovereign capacity has become really the touchstone of this. We are a nation that through various liberal / neoliberal reforms have chased certain forms of local industry away, probably the most recent example being the car industry under the Abbott government. No more subsidies. If you don't like it, you can go elsewhere. We're not going to subsidize this anymore. Why? Well, apart from all the moral arguments you want to make and human arguments you want to make about interdependence, it's just cheaper. Do we want to be making cars forever and making $120,000 cars that are not very good because of the cost of making them in Australia when compared with the cost of making them in Asia? You know that story. It becomes quite familiar. And yet, suddenly we face at a moment of crisis, like we are confronted with our lack of capacity. We don't make our own oil. We don't have enough oil to look after ourselves. While Donald Trump is celebrating that America has enough oil that it doesn't need the Strait of Hormuz. Actually more complicated than that, but let's just take that.
Because there's a single oil market. Yeah.
Yes, and the price will get set when that gets disrupted and so on. But nonetheless, better than not having it. Australia has gas. That gas we are using in a way quietly, I suppose, as leverage in our attempt to secure fuel. But nonetheless, why can't we just have fuel that sorts ourselves out? Why can't we just do that sort of thing? Arguments over whether it's fossil fuels or renewables, but the thrust is the same, self-sufficiency. And if we go back to one of the reasons we don't have self-sufficiency in all these things, some of that is natural. Nations can't be self-sufficient because they don't command all the necessary resources, but also really expensive to be self-sufficient. And we decided we didn't want that because we wanted to live lives that were more expansive, more lavish, cheaper, more efficient, and efficiency is a big part of that. Here's the question I think all this throws up, Scott. With the political movement back to putting a premium on sovereignty, to what extent do you think we are willing to pay for that? Because it's easy in the context of a crisis to say, well, I want the security. And I care about the security and I'll pay the security at any cost. That matters more than the efficiency. That matters more than the lowering of costs. That matters more than any of the other sort of ethical and moral dimensions you might want to talk about. But then when the crisis disappears, well, you're lumped with the expenses, aren't you? There's no doubt there is a really strong political movement in this direction. Look at all the conversations we're having on immigration, to say nothing of energy, to say nothing of manufacturing capability, even defence. But are we up to it? How much do you think this is crisis talk as opposed to a genuine philosophical realignment?
As we discussed a couple of weeks ago, I do feel that aspects of what you just described as crisis talk are still a hangover from the pandemic, when the experience of being a little bit too far down the global supply chain and therefore not necessarily in the position of assurance and of priority that we may have believed. That experience and the experience of being confronted with our own incapacity because of policy decisions that had been made over the last 30 years to either offshore or to simply import.
With huge complexities, by the way, that we don't always understand.
No,
is another aspect of this.
Yeah. Absolutely right. So there's something about that hangover that I still think, it's interesting to me how much the pandemic is coming up these days. Yeah. And it gives you the sense that in some ways we are still a nation that is living with the trauma of that, and yet we haven't quite reconciled ourselves to what it might mean to live otherwise. I like the way that you framed it. I like that this is for you a conversation about, are we willing to pay in the good times, in the stable times? Are we willing to pay for a different way of thinking about how we create our energy, how we manufacture and distribute our food, how we run and operate a $90 billion agricultural industry? Are we willing to pay more? Are we willing to sacrifice the inherent benefits that we regard? I think we understand them as the inherent benefits of relative cheapness in the good times in order to insulate ourselves against the inevitable shocks of an interdependent world. In some respects, though, Waleed, I think that it kind of depends what it is we're talking about, what form that interdependence takes. Can I throw sort of two complications in this? You may want to bat them away. You may want to address them. When we're talking about energy dependence or energy interdependence, energy sovereignty on the one hand, let's use more of our own resources. Let's export less of our liquid, of our LNG to other nations. Let's reserve more of it here. Let's drill. This has been something that is being increasingly advocated by a number of senators on one particular end of the political spectrum. Let's drill for more of our oil here and import less of it elsewhere. If we're talking about energy sovereignty, it does reveal, doesn't it, that for many people, energy sovereignty means going back to more stable, more known forms of fossil fuel-based energy. And that is because we are living in this time of rapid transition from older fossil fuel-based infrastructure, older fossil fuel-based energy supplies, to more electrified and renewables-based economy. But because over the last 15 years, so little of the international investment has gone into that old fossil fuel-based infrastructure, it's actually had the paradoxical effect of concentrating the sources of fossil fuel energy into a handful of relatively unreliable global partners. And so it's the very fact that we're in this uncomfortable position of transition from fossil fuels to renewables that makes our ability to swear off fossil fuels altogether such a fraught idea at this moment. And yet when most people do talk about energy sovereignty, becoming more reliant upon our own resources, it seems to me that what most people are talking about is going back, in fact, to our fossil fuel dependence and not really so much pushing ahead into greater reliance on renewables. And I think we're also seeing, Waleed, that final half, if you like, of our transition leading to 2035 to 2050, that last half is going to be very difficult. Swearing off, the final act of swearing off fossil fuels is going to be unbelievably disruptive, quite possibly immensely complicated.
To be fair to the Albanese government, though, the Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, is talking about renewables as being the way forward here.
Yes, of course.
That's the thing that opens up. I don't know that Anthony Albanese is talking that language in quite the same way as he's jetting around Asia trying to shore up fuel supplies. But, I mean, that would be understandable. And you say one particular senator, well, you're talking here about Matt Canavan, who's the leader of the Nationals, who's been very strong on this and very clear on this for quite a long period of time.
Well, there's also, is it Andrew Bragg? Andrew Bragg has also said that the environmental protection, Australia's environmental protection legislation is also preventing us from accessing the very resources that we most need access to at this very moment. And so, again, it feels to me like the very position of precarity, of insecurity, the desire for greater control over our resources, it may well not be spurring us to look towards a renewables-based future. It may well be encouraging us, tempting us, if you like, to revert to the past. The issue of food sovereignty is another really complicated one, though, Waleed, because for many people, it is the very fact that we export, 70% of Australia's agricultural business 70% of our agricultural produce gets exported overseas. That is the very fact that that massive amount of production has to be sustained through some really quite complex fertilizer-based agrochemical, agricultural, technological grounds. The very fact that we are so reliant on large industrial, agricultural, manufacturing, food production, that is the thing that guarantees us, that buys us cheaper groceries. That's what gives us the ability to purchase cheaper food. In other words, the only reason that we are able to have food that really reflects a very low margin that the farmers have to deal with is because so much of their crops are being exported. Now, that is an expression, I think, not so much of we need to make sure that we have our own food supply. We need to be sure that we're caring for our own resources. That reflects, if you like, the domestic benefits of interdependence. The only way that we could then wean ourselves off that is by having a different form of manufacturing, which is ethically credible, that is morally justifiable, but that abjures many of the very, very, very slim margins that our that grocery stores then impose upon farmers. And so, you know,
right. So it's basically go to an organic grocer with everything locally sourced and compare the prices.
So look, yeah. You know, sovereignty, I think, not becoming simply exposed to global instability. There is a kind of inherent value in that. But there are also lived values. There are lived benefits, are there not, to continuing with certain forms of principled interdependence. And I think one of the things that has been interesting about the Prime Minister's, it's sometimes been referred to now as petrodiplomacy, there does seem to be a certain benefit to hewing much more closely in our interdependent relationships with our immediate neighbors, with those that are sort of geographically proximate to us, and being less dependent on certain resources from elsewhere.
Oh, yeah.
I know. But I'm always concerned about language of energy nationalism, about language of energy sovereignty, as if it's trying to undo a system of international interdependence, of international codependence, and in some respects, not evenly distributed for sure, but international or mutual benefit. I do worry about the chest-beating dimensions of such an invocation of sovereignty without fully reckoning with what that might mean for the way that we live and the peacefulness then of our relationships with others.
Yeah, the expense that others would be paying as, yes.
So, not just immiserating ourselves, but other economies. No, that's right.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National, by the way. Waleed Ali, my name, Scott Stevens, is my co-host. The thing we haven't touched on here that I think is actually important is the psychic benefit of sovereignty.
That's true.
And here, I mean, I've made this point before. I apologize if I'm repeating myself, if you've heard me say this, but I think often of the soybean farmers in America who suffered greatly under Trump's trade war in his first presidency with China, who saw their business, they were selling so many soybeans to China, and they saw their business disappear to Brazil. Then they voted for Trump again in 2024, knowing he was pledging another round of tariffs, knowing what that would mean because they've experienced it. What's going on there? Responding to those people by saying, well, you know, this will make you poorer, isn't very helpful because they know this, but they're being offered something else. We discussed this, I think, in a previous episode.
We did.
The minefield. Yep. Okay. So what is surely happening there is that there is some psychic benefit to do with sovereignty, the notion of us being together, standing on our own two feet, even if that comes at an extra cost. One of the ironies, I think, of the current moment is that we don't actually yet have a fuel supply crisis. We have a cost crisis. The fuel is there. It just costs more. we might have a fuel supply crisis later. But in the face of the rising cost, we're saying we need our own fuel. Well, that would come with extra costs. So we'd actually be locking in the price rises, the cost of living dimension of this. We'd be locking that in, but we would have the psychic benefit, would we not, of knowing that there's a floor, that there is a base condition. And I wonder if there's something that happens in a world that becomes difficult to understand, even if it's as it's spectacular, where crises start to come at you in shapes you hadn't quite seen before and with a speed you hadn't quite seen before, where it becomes psychically hugely beneficial to put a floor under yourself as opposed to raising the ceiling above you. That as we retreat to the concept of necessity, that as so much of our life gathers around this notion of boom or bust, of precarity, that actually the elimination of precarity becomes the chief political idea, especially when you look around the world and see everybody else feeling the same way, everyone else starting to move in that sort of direction. We're not consistent with this, are we? The people who are very concerned about us surrendering our sovereignty in a deal like AUKUS, for example, are often not the same people who are talking about the benefits of interdependence. They are the same people talking about the benefits of interdependence and so on. They're not the same people saying, I'm really worried about more oil and gas. So there are all these political fissures. But in each case, what's going on there? There's something there about the centrality or the growing centrality of precarity in our lives and by extension then our politics. And if we can pay an extra fee to get rid of that feeling of precarity, then maybe the human thing is just to pay it.
Just going back to the 1973 oil crisis for a moment, you know, one of the things that made that so psychologically traumatic, traumatizing, particularly for North Americans, the idea that they were the victims of the use of energy as a weapon directed against them. There is something about the discretionary nature of the current war, the idea that someone, not because of a natural disaster, but someone has quite simply blocked something, someone has turned off a tap, that they are using the denial of a resource as a way of punishing others, as a way of inflicting pain. There is something about that, I think, that strikes, you might want to say, you know, that it deals a kind of psychological blow. It is certainly the thing that we heard repeatedly in the lead up to the Brexit referendum in 19. Yep. In 2016, the desire to take back control, even though in the aftermath of that, we've seen repeatedly just how hard it is to undo these particular cords.
And that it came at a cost.
And that it came at an immense cost.
But so, did you notice when Angus Taylor announced his immigration policy this week, the phrase take back control appears? Yeah.
Yeah.
Amongst a whole series of other phrases.
So look, the sense of precarity, you know, I don't think there is a political or moral or otherwise virtue in seeking out precarity, seeking out a delicate or a flimsy or potentially exploitable or fragile relationship. But I think it is something different to say that precarity simply is, that there is something about the way that we live and about the necessity of the ways that we live that throws us all into positions of precariousness. And while precarity isn't something we should necessarily embrace as if it were desirable, it's far more politically damaging to deny it. And any attempt to simply assert sovereign control, to simply, we will not be dependent for what we need on anybody else, there is something about that that feels to me like a kind of domestically oriented desire or attempt to deny the precariousness, the inherent precariousness of our existence, that then means that when those shocks that we cannot avoid really do come, then again, we are not democratically, we are certainly not socially capable of withstanding that blow without that blow beginning to make us turn against one another.
Sure, but democratic politics ultimately is founded on myths of control.
That's exactly right. We talked about that recently.
Yeah, and so who wins an election by coming out and say, you know what, we actually don't control most stuff? Show me a person who's going to win an election saying that.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's a, is it a myth? It's a myth that we have to keep going to sustain ourselves. And so as that idea, that feeling of control becomes scarcer, its value, it goes up. That's just basic economics, Scott, which brings us back to where we started. Well done, me. You're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. We try to negotiate the ethical moral dilemmas of modern life occasionally. Well, Willy Daly is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. And as always, we have someone to help pull us out of the mire.
Our guest is Hamish McKenzie. He's the Deputy Program Director of Grattan Institute's Energy and Climate Change Program, which I guess, Hamish, kind of gives you specialization across the very two areas that we most need help with. Thanks so much for joining us on The Mindfield.
It's great to be here, Scott. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Waleed.
So look, you've heard us dig ourselves into a little bit of a hole. Where do you want to take the conversation?
The thing that I kept thinking about as you guys were chatting is, let's rewind the clock 5 years. Imagine COVID's not happening, this scenario. Imagine the Prime Minister who would stand up in peace times when there's no fuel crisis, there's no fuel crisis in living memory, and said, I'm going to do something which is going to increase the cost that you pay at the Bowser every day forever to avoid a possible scenario in the future that seems in peacetime to be completely implausible, that might involve a bigger cost later. We know that Australia's had this 30 days of fuel stocks and the internationally accepted norm is 90. When they made that decision to only keep it at 30, it's based on a cost-benefit analysis that pushed up, that stock of 30 days pushed up the cost by about 15 cents a litre for everyone forever. But they did it because it would avoid $300 million of cost per day in the event of a crisis. Now, if you edge that up to 60 days or 90 days of fuel in your stocks, that 15 cents a litre goes up quite a bit. Now, it's going to be a really brave Prime Minister who goes up to the Australian people and says, I'm going to make your fuel maybe 30 cents more expensive to avoid something bad happening in the future. A kind of crisis that has no salience for people. I mean, even though we're in the middle of a fuel crisis now, the immediate response of the government was to cut the fuel excise because it's generally accepted that shouldering an increase in the price of fuel is kind of an unacceptable outcome. And so I think we need to think really hard about how do we incentivize our leaders in peacetime to make decisions that might be in the interests of the nation, even though they're trying to avoid costs and scenarios which are really or seem improbable in the cool light of day. And maybe once this energy crisis is over, we can start to think through, well, what other kinds of crises in the energy space, but also, you know, in health, in geopolitics, all sorts of things that might transpire in the next, you know, decades of this country. And what are the things which we should do today, which actually seem costly, which seem inconvenient, but might set us up to avoid some shocks into the future? I think that's the real test of do we learn the right lesson from this crisis?
But that's picking winners, isn't it?
In what sense?
Or losers. Well, you have to anticipate the crisis that will, I mean, because every crisis you prepare for that doesn't transpire becomes a very costly one.
Absolutely.
If you're going to try to respond to every imaginable crisis in this way, well, the whole thing falls apart. There's just no, I mean, for example, it might have turned out to be a brilliant idea in 2015 to say, I don't know, I just feel like building some quarantine centres out in the, and it would have turned out to be brilliant, but it would have been impossible to sell that as an idea in something like that.
Well, and state governments that did start building quarantine centres halfway through the pandemic, which then turned out not to be needed, were pilloried for that decision.
Right. As we demanded they do it in the midst of the crisis.
Exactly right.
Which probably brings us to this moment, doesn't it?
Well, exactly right. So let's look at the ways that governments and leaders are responding to the fuel crisis. You've got the Premier of Queensland going out to the Taroom Trough and saying he's standing above a sea of liquid gold that could supply the nation. Now, it's probably going to take 6-10 years if there is actually recoverable supply of oil in the Taroom Trough to get that to a point where it's actually supplying Australian customers. That's best case scenario. We have really no idea how much oil is under the ground there. We have two refineries, as we know. They're both being subsidised by the government. It's not clear if either of them could be repurposed to process that fuel. The idea that we can respond to this current crisis by digging the Taroom Trough is really, really hard to sustain. There's a there's a time lag here. The kinds of measures that you would put in place to solve an immediate crisis in the Strait of Hormuz are very different measures than you would take to secure Australia's energy sovereignty, however you want to describe that, into the long term. 10 years' time is going to be the mid-2030s. That's the point at which Australia has already committed and really needs to be very advanced in decarbonising our economy. We need to have millions of electric vehicles on the roads. We actually want to be reducing our dependence on oil at precisely the moment that something like the Taroom Trough would start to supply the country. And so we need to think very soberly about what is a knee-jerk reaction to an acute crisis and what's a sensible strategic move to secure energy supplies whilst not causing different kinds of problems for the country further down the track.
But again, Hamish, doesn't this reflect the fact that over the last 10, 15 years, we've tried, I mean, okay, we have continued to subsidize certain forms. We have prolonged certain forms of fossil fuel energy consumption or production, but we've not done anything like the active investment in those forms of fossil fuel-based technologies or oil extraction or whatever else. The very fact, the very temptation to respond to a crisis like this would be sort of taken up at the very moment when it seems to me that we would be least capable of engaging in, I mean, to say nothing of sort of politically least advantageous. There is something, though, about our tendency to see forms of fossil fuel-based energy as being more durable, more ours, more reliable, more certain than something as ephemeral. And here I'm probably just simply talking about national psychology, but something as ephemeral. And then we hear about sort of baseload and variations of supply and something as sort of ephemeral almost as renewables or solar.
And also as in flux, that's the other
flux,
part
yeah,
of it.
Yeah,
Scott, is that you can, if I told you we're going to build, you know, we're going to have an oil refinery, or we're going to drill for oil or whatever. I know what it is. It's not changing in a hurry. I get it. I can be pretty guaranteed in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, it's going to look something like what I got now. Argument about a commercial case and all that sort of stuff. But we're beyond making a commercial case at this point. Mm. It's a sovereign case we're making. Once we talk about renewables, I feel like in 3 years' time, it's going to be a totally different conversation. And I don't know any part of the world, and this is the Matt Canavan argument, as soon as you get to about 30% renewables, the costs skyrocket, all these sorts of things. So it's also the imponderable nature of these things that feeds directly into the kind of calculation we're trying to make. Mm.
I think we're really looking at two different sets of precarity or two sets of uncertainty. A fossil fuel economy is not an economy impervious to disruption, as we can see right
now. That's
right. Yeah. We've got a crisis in the Middle East, which is radically affecting the Australian economy. Even if we just look inside Australia, an oil refinery on fire in Geelong a couple of weeks ago, a Category 3 cyclone went across the north and the west of Australia and shut down about 40% of Western Australia's gas production. These are three completely unrelated events, which all happened to occur at the same time, which have really quite drastically disrupted huge parts of Australian life. We don't have to go back very far to look at the last time this happened. When Russia invaded Ukraine, it disrupted global gas markets. Australia is connected to global gas markets, even though we are more than self-sufficient in gas, because we export a huge amount of gas. At the time, we were the second largest exporter of gas in the world. An increase in global gas prices pushed up prices for Australian consumers. The price of gas is linked to the price of electricity. It caused an electricity price crisis. It's very difficult to sustain the idea that a fossil fuel-based economy protects us from disruptions. Now, again, that's not to say that a renewable economy protects us any better. It introduces a slightly different set of vulnerabilities. Australia doesn't manufacture at any meaningful scale solar panels, batteries, wind turbines. We import basically all of that.
But we export many of the components, many of the minerals needed to construct them.
Absolutely right. But the point is, if we wanted to move to a completely energy independent economy, then shifting to renewables doesn't solve the problem. What we would have to do is shift to renewables and also develop industries capable of manufacturing the inputs required for that, which at the moment, no one really is suggesting that we will be able to do.
But the sovereignty push is also about
boosting manufacturing.
Absolutely. But just take solar panels as an example. The government has its Sunshot program, which is about developing Australian capability to manufacture solar panels. But this is an extremely long-term project. It starts with manufacturing polysilicon and then moves into manufacturing wafers. We're a long way off producing solar panels of the quality and in the volumes that would be required, not just to meet Australian demand for solar today, but to sustain an economy that's running on even higher levels of renewables. And then if you want to double or triple electricity production in this country to generate new industries, again, that's an even more challenging task. The point being, there's no short-term or medium-term future in which a renewable-based economy protects Australia from being deeply connected, deeply enmeshed in global networks of trade and interdependency. So the point is not that there is a set of options available to us to cut ourselves off from the world, generate all of our electricity, generate all of our goods here. It is really about selecting the kinds of vulnerabilities and the kinds of relationships that we think are serving our country best. They'll be very different in a renewable-based economy than a fossil fuel-based economy, but the vulnerabilities don't go away.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. That voice belongs to Hamish McKenzie, Deputy Program Director of the Grattan Institute's Energy and Climate Change Program. Well, Ali, my name's Scott Stevens, my co-host. I suppose the tricky thing with this, Hamish, is you can't hold everything constant and tweak one variable. I mean, you talk about the fact that we export so much gas. Yes, we do. But in a newly sovereign Australia, we might do a bit less of that. Because that's the whole point. Why do we export so much gas? Well, you can talk about interdependence. You can talk about mutually beneficial relationships. We give you gas, you give us oil, etc. Yes, we talk about that. But another version of this, which I would say is gaining in political salience, is we export so much gas because there are all these greedy gas companies that want to make heaps of money, and they can make heaps of money that way. That shouldn't happen. We should be first. And so I don't want to put the profits of greedy gas companies above the needs of ordinary Australians. There's a version of that argument widely available to you. If we started to make those sorts of tweaks, can you see us getting to a point where the vulnerability is lessened in a way that would be satisfying, that would be psychically and perhaps even politically satisfying, even if it did come at an extra cost?
I think the first thing to say is I haven't heard of anybody arguing for that kind of sovereignty. Even the people arguing for a shift to a renewable-based economy are arguing this will underpin new kinds of export industries and things like ammonia, steel. People are talking about sinking subsea cables to Singapore and selling electricity. Mm. What that would do is link us to the Singaporean electricity price, and that would come with its own set of costs in the same way that being linked to the gas market links us to the Japanese price.
But take the fossil fuel approach where it's like, right, we've got all this gas, we're really going to lean into it, we're going to use it.
Well, if we wanted to kiss goodbye to exporting these kinds of industries, then we'd have to accept saying goodbye to a huge source of income as a country. It's just a fact that we make a lot of money as an exporting country. If we wanted to cease that kind of exports, then we're going to have to reconcile ourselves to a much smaller economy. Australia has never seen that kind of existence before. Even people like Andrew Hastie are not arguing for that kind of approach. What we see is two different kinds of interdependency in terms of the export orientation. Are we going to be a fossil fuel exporter forever? And we are really an export superpower in terms of fossil fuels. We're a top exporter of coal and gas. Or are we going to wind down those industries and replace them with different kinds of export industries? I think the important point is that these aren't the kinds of decisions that can be made on a short-term cycle of like a three-year election term. This is really a fundamental question about what kind of economy we want to have. If the Prime Minister's standing up in the National Press Club and saying, gone are the days where we can assume that there's always going to be someone willing to sell us a product for cheaper than we can make it here, what we might be seeing is actually much more than a shift in policy of one government, but a transition from one kind of settlement of we can trade, we can import and export forever to a different kind of settlement where we actually have to make and consume a lot more of our stuff here, and actually those export relationships are quite different. Now, I think we're a long way off a transition from an export and trade-oriented settlement to a different settlement. I think that what we're seeing in the political debate at the moment is really just about substituting certain kinds of important export industries for another.
So we're in the grip, it seems to me, of a contradiction, a dilemma that very quickly becomes a democratic dilemma. And I think it goes something like this. Please correct me if I'm wrong, if you think I'm wrong. That relationships of international interdependence, where one nation produces more than it needs to and then exports the lion's share, exports its excess. Relationships of international interdependence are relationships of and they sustain an economy of abundance, where there is, for the most part, generally speaking, more than enough. You could also call these economies that are predicated on prosperity. So if we simply think about this in terms of food, Australia produces far more food, far more agricultural products than we need to, because there is a certain benefit economically to exporting our excess food, some 70% of it, elsewhere. That then enables consumers to receive the relative benefit of cheaper produce, of cheaper foodstuffs on our supermarket shelves. But it's all predicated on this prior relationship of interdependence. You might want to call it prior relationship of importing and exporting. The only way of creating the kind of shift in the way that we live, in the sort of economy that we want, that could legitimately fall within the description of being sovereign / self-sufficient, is for us to begin pulling back on the prosperity / abundance side of things. This is what we mean when we say being willing to pay a little bit more for goods, or in some cases, significantly more, because there is less of it being produced, or because it is being produced under different circumstances. So the benefit is we're more certain about supply. The detriment is it's going to cost more in the meantime, which must mean necessarily that we are willing to live under conditions that are less predicated on the fact of abundance or of prosperity. And that, it seems to me, inevitably means being willing to live within democratic societies that are predicated on the reality of self-restraint, of self-limitation, or to put it in the proper political parlance, sacrifice.
And solidarity.
And solidarity. That's exactly right.
Is this why,
yeah,
whether you like it or not, this has to be coupled with a migration policy?
Mm.
Because if you take the coalition at their word in their migration policy, I mean, can I boil it down to this? Migrants more like us, our national imaginary, are better than migrants less like us. I don't think I'm being unfair in describing it that way. Would that enhance a kind of sense of solidarity, a preparedness to sacrifice for one another and so on? I mean, in the end, do all these sovereignties have to come together, Hamish?
What? Perhaps America is a good example of that kind of moral intuition. A lot of the argument in favour of the wave of tariffs that we've seen out of the current administration, not from the president himself, but from others and intellectuals in that space, really makes that argument that, yes, the cost of goods in America is going to go up as a result of this approach to imposing tariffs. But that actually long-term, the economic certainly, but also that cultural benefit of independence and less reliance on adversarial nations is actually worth that cost. You don't hear it so much said explicitly outside intellectual circles, but that trade-off of, yes, there is a cost increase, but that it is worth it for these other things which we have started to value in ways that we didn't in the 80s and the 90s, you do hear that coming out of America. I think we're a long way off that in Australia. Yeah. Even if you look at the Prime Minister's address to the nation just before Easter, I thought it was remarkable that his emphasis was on the lack of disruption. You know, fill up in the way that you usually would
just no
on
more.
Your Easter holidays. Just no more.
Yeah.
But no one has to make any sacrifices. Yes, there's stuff happening overseas, but it hasn't come here and we can go about our business as normal. There's this real emphasis on stasis, on avoiding inconvenience. I think it would be a huge jump from there to start seeing politicians actually surfacing the trade-offs of decisions that would increase costs for Australian consumers in some sort of long-term sense.
Maybe the way to ask it is the other way around. Would a society that has pledged to undertake these costs for the sake of sovereignty, for the sake of eliminating vulnerability or reducing, eliminates the wrong word, reduce vulnerability, precarity, so on, would it become, by dint of that experience, a more cohesive society? Would it become one that becomes just more solidaristic over time because the experience inculcates that? Or the flip side, is a society that's constantly about independence, about complex supply chains, about the movement of everything, about eliminating the difference between here and there, has that become a society that's less capable of solidarity?
A very specific energy sector example springs to mind that maybe elucidates something about the Australian psyche here. We've seen a lot of people installing home batteries in the last year or so because of the government subsidy scheme. When a household installs a home battery, they have got to make a decision. Do they let their retailer take control of that battery or not? Now, you make money from giving your retailer control of the battery. But most people really bristle at that concept. Yep. Most people who get a battery are getting it precisely because they don't want their retailer to have control. They don't want that hand coming in and switching things off or on in ways that they can't see and control.
It's high-tech survivalism.
It's high-tech survivalism, but it's gone mainstream.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting case in micro of this sense of, I want to stand on my own two feet. I want to generate my own power. I don't want to be dependent on the grid. I don't want to be dependent on my retailer. And I don't want them to see what I'm doing. Maybe it's possible that if we move towards this general kind of Fortress Australia approach, then the solidarity doesn't start at the level of the nation, it starts at the level of the household, and actually we become a much more kind of individualistic society with higher walls around our houses.
Would it be different though if it wasn't a company that I was sending it back to, but the people in whatever form that takes?
Well, you tell me, Waleed. Do you think people would react differently if it was Albo coming in and saying, trust me, I'll control your battery well, or the energy market operator, or the electricity network? I'm not sure. I think for most people, it's sort of the distinctions between these entities kind of get elided, and actually what it is some sort of bureaucratic structure that I can't see or understand or control. Is doing something that's exploiting me, and I don't feel good about it.
Mm. We've spun in a libertarian direction that's impossible to retrieve, it sounds like.
Well, look, that's battery owners. That's a small subset of the population.
It's a great example, though. It's a really, really interesting example because it's elemental. There's the rational response, and then the people are not opting, or they don't like that rational response. It says there is something else going on there. The way you're painting it makes it sound like it's an individualistic thing that's going on there. It's about freedom from, it's about breaking the bond.
Mm.
Mm. Mm. Are there any circumstances in which it might be about forging one?
Well, look, we do know from a huge amount of social science research in the energy sector that one thing that people do really like is kind of that idea that you alluded to before. They really like the idea that they might be able to share their excess power with a friend or a neighbour or a local, you know, aged care facility or something like that. So there is, you know, there are these circumstances that can activate people's sense of communitarianism. Yeah, I suppose it's a fascinating example because it's one where people are willing to forego some money for that sake of independence, but they're also willing to give something away for free if they understand who it's going to.
Oh, wow. Can that be cast across a nation? I've got to go away and think about that, Hamish, which is just as well, because we're out of time. It's been such a stimulating conversation. Thanks very much for dropping in.
Thanks for having me.
Hamish McKenzie, Deputy Program Director of Grattan Institute's Energy and Climate Change Program, our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which is now at an end. You can catch us again on Radio National next week, or you can listen to us anytime on ABC Listen. See you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.